Our fourth case of the morning is King against the Burlington Northern Railroad. Mr. Bischoff.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, John Bischoff on behalf of Geraldine King, counsel. This case involves my client, Geraldine King, who was a longtime employee of the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. The last 2 years of her career, she was a ticket agent at the Aurora Station. During that time, there was an audit conducted that showed that there was missing a pack of 10 ride tickets. In the packet, there were 100 tickets.
Mr. Bischoff, let me ask you maybe the central question that concerns me about this case, which I think you're arguing, but you can clarify. And that is what the record shows and how much time there was to develop evidence about Burlington Northern's knowledge as of March 24th, which is when I gather this complaint was filed. It sounds to me like they were in the early stages, anyway, of their investigation. Did they know by that time? Did they have this evidence of the signatures on the receipts or which train it was from Aurora that was involved?
My understanding, the sequence of events was shortly after the conductors that were put on notice to look for these missing tickets came in after that date with the...
After the 24th.
After
March.
The 24th. Also, the photo...
Here's the reason I'm asking. This case, of course, is about malicious prosecution. And the question, as I understand it, is whether on March 24th, when the criminal complaint was filed, there was probable cause to believe that she had committed a crime. If, hypothetically, Burlington Northern didn't have probable cause until April the 15th, and I'm just picking a day out of the air, then they didn't have probable cause on the 24th of March. And I just want to know, how much does this record bring out the temporal sequence?
The most important piece of the puzzle is when, in fact, Inspector Lang had filed the criminal complaint against Ms. King. The sequence of events are pretty much in the record that's attached to the appendix as to when the crews during a certain period of time of the trains were notified of the missing tickets, when they found certain individuals, certain passengers with these tickets. That sequence of events is pretty much memorialized in the record. They all occur after the March 24th date.
Okay, so if I'm understanding your argument correctly, it's that the arbitration or the dispute resolution procedures that BNSF undertakes are focusing on the question whether she did something wrong, and they aren't really focusing on by what time Burlington Northern knew that she probably had done something wrong.
That's one of the issues we're presenting, Your Honor, and plus the fact of not having any discovery to be able to expand on those issues.
Well, that's right. The district court was very frustrated, though, that you failed to specify exactly what you were hoping to get from discovery. She was trying to look at the issue.
Well, it's difficult to say what else do I need in discovery to answer a motion for summary judgment when, in fact, I didn't have any discovery at all. I said I wanted to take the deposition of the general chairman so that I could show that the proceedings aren't anywhere near a fair and complete hearing.
But I understand that. But the judge kept saying, well, suppose there's this stipulation, suppose there's that. What is it? And one thing you might have said is, I need to know ex ante. You know, what did they know as of the time this thing was filed? Footnote 2 in the district court's opinion says the date of filing is disputed. And so maybe you might have said, we need to nail down the date of filing. She was very concerned that you didn't tell her what you were trying to get from discovery.
We went through requests for admissions. One of the requests for admissions was to say on such and such date, Inspector Lang filed the criminal complaint against the plaintiff. The answer to that admission was, yes, he did, but we don't know the date. Now, how can they not know the date their own
date
employer.
Date is a matter of public record, I will tell you. It's very easy to find out if you call the circuit court.
That file is missing, Your Honor.
No, it's not, actually. At least either that or the circuit court.
I sent someone to Kane County, and that file is missing.
Could you help me on the question about the requirements under Illinois law? Suppose Burlington Northern filed criminal complaints against every clerk in this ticket office, and it turned out that one of the clerks was the thief. Could the person who turned out to be the thief, even though Burlington Northern didn't learn that until after making the criminal complaint, pursue a malicious prosecution complaint?
I believe so, because we're talking about intent, and that's something that, based on the bare facts that the court has given me, I would say yes.
I could understand how the people who weren't the thief could file the complaints. Right? Suppose there are three clerks who might be it. There's a one-third chance of each, let's suppose that's less than probable cause. So Burlington Northern files criminal charges against all three of them, and we later learn which one did it. I mean, I should think the outcome would be the one who did it recovers nothing in the civil suit, and the two who were charged falsely recover in the civil suit. But you seem to be arguing that the one who did it recovers in the civil suit, even if there's a criminal trial and a criminal conviction.
Based on the fact that we're looking at what the intent was, what was the information that the railroad had at the time.
I'm giving you the hypothetical. They filed charges against everybody who might have been the thief, not knowing who was the thief, and then we later learn from a criminal conviction who the thief was. That's all we know. What happens under Illinois law?
I think under Illinois law, the court has answered that question because of the fact that didn't know who it was, so they really didn't, in good faith, file.
What state case would you rely on for the proposition that somebody who actually is criminally convicted could recover for malicious prosecution on the ground that when the criminal case began, there wasn't yet probable cause?
I can't cite a case, Your Honor.
I can tell you the answer to this question. One of the elements of Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical is that there is a termination of the criminal proceeding that is not in favor of the defendant. So in your case, there we have that, whereas, of course,
this case
we have a more ambiguous termination. Right. We have an abandonment of the criminal proceeding, so element two is different. Maybe not dispositively so. You might go to element five. Are there actual damages to the plaintiff given the fact that, let's say, civil measures showed that she did it, quote unquote, if that's what we have?
I misunderstood your question, Your Honor.
Well, Judge Pallmeyer reviews at the bottom of page 7 and the top of page 8 of her opinion the five elements of a malicious prosecution claim under Illinois law. We've all been discussing element three, the absence of probable cause for the proceeding. That's an ex ante inquiry. Judge Easterbrook is asking, well, could you ever have a malicious prosecution claim if, in fact, somehow or another, through an arbitration proceeding, through a civil lawsuit, through a criminal lawsuit, it becomes clear that the person was guilty? And in terms of the criminal lawsuit, element two tells you there has to be a termination of the proceeding in favor of the defendant somehow. It doesn't answer the question, what if there's some other way that we learn that the person in question, here Ms. King, actually stole the tickets? What happens then? Is there an Illinois case where something other than a criminal prosecution has answered that question?
Are we speaking specifically what are her damages then?
Well, I'm asking, yes, part
it's
of about
this
damages.
Case, it's a hypothetical.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. It's what does Illinois law say if you have a criminal proceeding that's terminated in favor of the defendant, but I'll just say broadly, in a civil proceeding, it becomes clear that the defendant did it. Think of the O.J. case. You know, he gets acquitted in the criminal case, and then there's a wrongful death action on a preponderance, and it turns out he was the perpetrator.
That would be then the malicious prosecution case, and that would have been determined by the trier of fact. Here we didn't have that.
Do you say that's enough to go to that? That's you've satisfied all, at least for purposes of getting.
Okay. Is there some state case? We'll come back to on the forget the criminal. Take my hypothetical again. The criminal charges are filed against all three clerks. and civil lawsuits are filed by the railroad against all three clerks. Right? Criminal charges end up being dismissed, but in the civil litigation, the state court finds and the Supreme Court of Illinois affirms that X was the thief. Could X then recover for malicious prosecution? Are there any state cases addressing that question?
No, but my assumption would be yes, because of the difference in the burdens of proof, that there was a finding of not guilty, and that's the only thing, only one of the elements that you need for a malicious prosecution case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bischoff. Mr. Whitehead.
May it please the court and counsel, James Whitehead for defendant BN. Judge Wood, let me address the question that you raised on the issue of what does the record show concerning the date of the filing of the criminal complaint, because I understand Your Honor is troubled about that possibility.
And what I'm specifically troubled about is the fact that probable cause is not the kind of thing that can be furnished ex post, and a lot of the proceedings that went on look to me to be relying on evidence that was developed after the date of the filing.
Well, but that, of course, presupposes that there is evidence that the case was, in fact, filed on March 24th, and there is no such evidence, as Judge Pallmeyer indicated in her opinion.
And why isn't that a disputed issue of material fact, then, since we can't ascertain probable cause without knowing that date?
Well, Judge, it seemed to me that it was the plaintiff's burden, if this is, in fact, the argument that was being made, to come forward in response to the motion for summary judgment, either with admissible evidence as to the date of the filing of the criminal complaint, or alternatively, a Rule 56F affidavit establishing why she could not present admissible evidence, either by way of her own affidavit or some other admissible evidence. This is truly a red herring in my judgment, Your Honor, because what the record shows is, if you'll recall, the railroad learned in early March that this block of 100 tickets was missing. It sent out a memorandum to all the conductors on the Metro lines asking them to look for the numbers. They found a ticket. This was the first piece of evidence they had. They found that ticket on March 26, 2003. That is established in the record.
That's why I don't think it's a red herring, because the crux of your argument has been that I'll call them the arbitration proceedings, the Railway Labor Act proceedings addressed precisely the same issue as we need to have resolved for the malicious prosecution case. And it seems to me that it was not, in fact. It was a proceeding going to the ultimate question, was Ms. King the person who stole the 110 ride tickets, whereas for the probable cause determination, we have a more specific inquiry, what was known as of the date of filing. I gather no one is arguing it was much later than March 26th. Might have been the 24th. Defendant has no knowledge. The court just sort of breezes by that point.
Well, the court breezes by it because the plaintiff did not submit any evidence in response to the motion for summary judgment to suggest that, in fact, the criminal charge was filed as early as the 24th. And all of the evidence that is before the court, I would submit, is to the contrary. Because the ticket that focused the attention of the investigation on Ms. King was not sold until March 24th. The ticket that was ultimately identified by the conductor on March 26th was the ticket that had been sold itself on March 24th at approximately 5:15 in the morning. Now, Your Honor, I apologize that we did not take the step that Your Honor is suggesting of actually attempting to find in the court files, if that's available, or get from the state's attorney's office the actual date of the complaint. We did not have any of that information in the Burlington Northern records.
In principle, that should be a matter of public record.
It should be, Your Honor, but the plaintiff is asserting here, without any evidence whatsoever, that the criminal complaint was filed on March 24th, and I'm suggesting to Your Honors that there is that all of the record evidence that is before the court and was before Judge Pallmeyer creates a necessary inference that, in fact, the criminal complaint against Ms. King alone, not against all of the ticket sellers in the Aurora office, was done after the focus of the investigation occurred on her, and that was
I understand the logic of what you're saying, but if this is a malicious prosecution allegation, and if, hypothetically, the complaint was filed on the 24th or the 20th or, you know, some other date, more along the lines of Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical, let's just file criminal complaints against everybody, it would look a lot more like a malicious prosecution case.
It certainly would, Judge, but I think the question the court has to determine is who had the obligation to present the court with admissible evidence establishing that the railroad, even before it had learned of any tickets attributed to Ms. King, nonetheless sought her, focused on her, and maliciously decided, well, we're going to charge Ms. King. We won't charge the other ticket sellers at Aurora, even though they all had access to the tickets as well.
But it is narrowed down at least to the Aurora station from the very beginning, right?
It is, because apparently that the inventory that was conducted was an inventory at Aurora. But as Your Honors, I suspect, know from general common knowledge, the Aurora station is a large station on the metro system, and there were ticket sellers, many ticket sellers, who worked out of the Aurora station other than Ms. King. But no criminal charges were filed against anyone until after the railroad determined that the ticket in question appeared to have been sold by her, both because she was uniquely the only ticket seller selling tickets at the time this ticket was, in fact, sold, and secondly, because the passenger to whom it was sold was able to identify her in a photo lineup. I agree with Your Honor. If, in fact, the plaintiff had produced admissible evidence or had come in with a Rule 56 affidavit explaining why he could not, to establish that the criminal charges were filed days, weeks, or months prior to having any evidence whatsoever that Ms. King was the guilty party, there would be an interesting question of malicious prosecution under Illinois law. Then we would be presented with the question of whether or not a malicious prosecution claim would lie when you lack probable cause at the moment you file the criminal complaint but acquire it some days later. And that, I suppose, the answer might be that would speak to the question of the quantum of damages that you
right.
have suffered. But, of course, you know, in this instance, Your Honor, there's just no admissible evidence in this record that the railroad filed the criminal charge prior to the time it had quite reasonable evidence that Ms. King was responsible.
So it sounds to me, actually, then, like all of this discussion of the rules of collateral estoppel, as it's mentioned here, and whether it's federal or Illinois or mm-hmm. whatever, is really all beside the point. That if what this is simply a case of failure of proof of an essential element, it doesn't make any difference.
Well, the way the case was presented to Judge Pallmeyer, Your Honor, didn't focus on this question that they filed the criminal charge before they had sufficient evidence. The argument before Judge Pallmeyer was, we don't care when they filed the criminal charge, they didn't have adequate evidence ever, and the ultimate determination by the RLA arbitrators that there was not only convincing but compelling evidence of her guilt is not entitled to collateral estoppel effect.
Right, but that just seems to me to misunderstand what it is to talk about probable cause. I mean,
I agree.
Sure, there comes a point when all, maybe not all in some existential sense, but in the human sense, all uncertainties are now resolved. And I'm sure your position is after the RLA board says we find clear and convincing evidence, albeit circumstantial, but an awful lot of it, that she did it, that's fine. And if they had filed the criminal complaint the next day, You wouldn't be here.
No, but Judge, we're not arguing that our probable cause only arose as a result of the RLA arbitration decision. That is certainly not the argument we're making.
No,
now,
you
the
were
RLA
saying
decision
you were
creates collateral estoppel, but Your Honor is correct.
The evidence that the RLA board was looking at, whether it was
yes.
the chits that she, you know, the receipts that she was signing or the
yes.
times of day the tickets were sold, I understand.
And the absence of any overage in her cash drawer, her personal cash drawer, tremendously important factor here. And as of today, the plaintiff has never come forward with any rational explanation for how all of this could have happened. The explanation that was proffered both in the district court and to the arbitrator was, well, somebody slipped these additional tickets in amongst the tickets that I was selling in numerical sequence. But that can't be squared with the undisputed fact that the cash drawer never showed any overage on any of the three incidents that were the subject of the arbitrations. Your Honor, I recognize the quandary that we are in because we don't know the precise date of the filing of the criminal charge. But again, the question is, who had the burden to present admissible evidence on that issue so as to create a genuine issue of material fact? And I would submit that it was the party opposing the motion for summary judgment. It's not simply sufficient for counsel to assert without any evidence whatsoever that the criminal charge was filed on March 24th. I would submit to you that the evidence in the record is all to the contrary, that the focus on Ms. King occurred after the ticket was found on March 26th And indeed, as I've suggested to you, it couldn't have been on March 24th. That was the date the ticket was sold, the ticket that ultimately triggered the investigation and focused on her. My time is up. I believe our brief adequately establishes the basis for our argument that the RLA decision is entitled to collateral estoppel effect. And with respect to the questions of reopening discovery, I think the brief deals with that, too. As this Court has time and time held, the failure to come forward with a Rule 56 affidavit itself is a sufficient basis for the denial of the motion to take additional discovery. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.